Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never. And I hope everybody's starting to understand the importance of nuances in words, as well as how important the word means when it comes to the law. And the only way you can get the insight of how and why those words changed really is by actually going through this and then in the ratification debates of how it was explained and why those words were used. Remember, this is a very insightful document, and it actually helps show the compromises that these men made in forming a union, a truly a perpetual union, not the failed perpetual confederation, but a perpetual union of the states. Now, we left off halfway through this diatribe of the admission of states that actually went from the 29th into the 30th. And so as they came back on the 30th, they continued to debate this. And there's still a few pages, a little over a page, to cover about a page and a half. Mr. Dickinson then moved to add the following clause to the last, quote, "Nor shall any state be formed by the junction of two or more states or parts thereof without the consent of the legislature of such states as well as the legislature of the United States," in other words, Congress, "which was agreed to without count of votes." I mean, it's unanimous or no question. Mr. Carroll moved to add, quote, "provided nevertheless that nothing in this Constitution shall be construed to affect the claim of the United States to vacant lands ceded to them by the Treaty of Peace." In other words, close quote. This, he said, might be understood as relating to the lands not claimed by any particular states, but he had in the view also some of the claims of particular states. Mr. Wilson was against the motion. There was nothing in the Constitution affecting one way or the other the claims of the United States. It was best to insert nothing, leaving everything on that litigated subject in status quo. Mr. Madison considered the claim of the United States as in fact favored by the jurisdiction of the judicial power of the United States over controversies to which they would be parties. He thought it best on the whole to be silent on the subject. He did not view the proviso of Mr. Carroll as dangerous, but to make it neutral and fair, it ought to go further and declare the claims of the particular states should also not be affected. In other words, that it becomes the final topping on the establishment or the admission of new states, because this is where the federal government is able to make claims over those things that had been ceded by others or had been abandoned. Any of the land out there that does not have a legitimate claim or, again, has been granted to the federal government, it becomes a territory of the United States. And as it says here that as we go through this, let me go back to Article 1, Section 4, and we want this final part that says, "And nothing in this Constitution shall be so construed as to prejudice any claims of the United States or any of a particular state." So in other words, as they're looking at land, if it is something within the state land. So this right here basically says that once this state becomes a sovereign state, the federal government cannot make any claims to anything within that state unless it is something that has been purchased by the cession of the state in granting them the ability to create a fort, magazine, and so forth, or needful buildings and so forth, as enumerated in Article 1, Section 8. So as we kind of go forward here, and Madison made that comment, Mr. Sherman thought that the proviso harmless, especially with the addition suggested by Mr. Madison in favor of the claims of particular states. Mr. Baldwin did not wish, Mr. Baldwin did not wish any undue advantage to be given to Georgia. He thought the proviso proper with the addition proposed. It should be remembered that if Georgia has gained much on the cession in the Treaty of Peace, she was in danger during the War of the UT Positidis, and I have no idea what the UT Positidis is. That's probably Indians, I guess, the UT Indians. Anyway, Mr. Rutledge thought it wrong to insert a proviso where there was nothing which it could restrain or on which it could operate. Mr. Carroll withdrew his motion and moved the following, quote, "Nothing in this Constitution shall be construed to alter the claims of the United States or of the individual states to the Western Territory, but all claims shall be examined into and decided by the Supreme Court of the United States." In other words, they were going to dictate how it was going to go. Governor Morris moved to postpone this in order to take up the following, quote, "The legislature shall have power to dispose of and make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory or property belonging to the United States, and nothing in this Constitution contained shall be so construed as to any prejudice or claims either of the United States or of any particular state. The postponement agreed to, no contest." So in other words, they accepted that language. Now, Mr. Martin moved to amend the proposition of Mr. Governor Morris by adding, "but all such claims may be examined into and decided upon by the Supreme Court." In other words, making a really tying this into the Supreme Court had to get involved in the admission of states and on the claims of the lands according to territories and so forth. And then Mr. Governor Morris said, "This is unnecessary as all suits to which the U.S. are parties are already to be decided by the Supreme Court." In other words, it was a little bit kind of redundant in basically giving them the authority and then making, hey, they have to decide this. Mr. L. Martin basically said, it is proper in order to remove all doubt from this point. On question on Mr. L. Martin's mandatory motion, no. For Massachusetts and New Hampshire, Connecticut, no. New Jersey said yes. Pennsylvania, no. Delaware, no. Maryland said yes. Virginia, no. And the states not further called because the negatives were sufficient and given up at this point. So in other words, only two votes in their favor. on the motion of Governor Morris was then agreed and moved, alone dissenting. So anyway, so that is how it all shaped up into forming. So bottom line, when this all started, they wanted disadvantages for the new states. They wanted to create advantages for themselves. They wanted to be equally guilty, like the British, as to constraining those colonies. Let's call these colonies the interior states that were going to be forming to the West, to the United States, and that they would not have equal suffrage representation, period. And that all fell by the wayside, that each of these states came in, and there's nowhere in here where there's any language that actually provides the general government any advantages over those states than the other states. I want to be clear here. They have no claim in these states other than those that are enumerated. In other words, when the states join the Union, and so this takes me back to, let me finish my thought. So as states join the Union, the federal government cannot make claims to say, we're keeping this land. that is a violation of the Constitution. The only way they can keep have any land within a state, as soon as that state formed, boom. I mean, as magical as it is, when that state is finally formed and created by the county delegates informing the Constitution in that state, the name and where its capital and all that stuff's going to be, when that happens, then the entire land in the boundary, within the boundaries of that state, are now fully relinquished to that state completely. Any land that exists within that state, the federal government will need to buy. So technically, if there is a fort, because we were, as they were moving west, they created the forts, I don't think that they necessarily needed to buy that land. It would just be kind of earmarked that, okay, we want to keep that fort because we still have them there, Indians that we're not on peace with, and we need to have some protection and security from the militia. And or the state militia should have actually taken that over. Nevertheless, only those things enumerated in the Constitution does the state or does the federal government have any ability to operate once that state forms. They can operate a needful building for whatever is enumerated in the Constitution, such as a port of entry. They just can't say, we want a building. We want to make a really nice building, and it's going to be a casino. They can't do that. They have no authority to inflict that type of debauchery upon the states. States are sovereign, and this is how they've been backdooring the sovereignty of states and corrupting people. Oh, well, it's okay. What's the harm? Sex trafficking. I mean, it's all the evil. If you look at how bad things are today, what's the harm? Don't even make me start listing it. We need to get back to the rule of law. They don't have the authority. They can't do it. It has to be undone. Those things that they possess are illegitimate if it is not enumerated. It's that simple, folks. The Constitution does not have any of these, I'll just say, this living Constitution doesn't exist. The way that they have contorted and have aggrandized what they can do is all the color of law. These are all infractions. So anybody that looks at the federal government says, that's all legitimate. Look at they've legitimized all of this. No, they just got everybody to believe it's legitimate. If you wake up and say, you know, that's technically not legitimate, you can't make me think otherwise. Now, they may, you know, incarcerate you, and they may oppress you and do things because they're already doing things that are harmful. Right? They're already doing oppression. They're waging warfare. So they're going to do what they can to protect themselves. Right? I mean, that's the nature, especially when you're a thug. You know, you don't expect a thug to, you know, be, you know, really civilized. Well, you know, we're going to abide by, you know, Sunday and not kill and not spray. And, you know, we're going to, you know, observe the Sabbath day, right? Anyway, so as we kind of move further down, we're going into this long diatribe. Actually, they go through all of these different things. They start forming stuff. And so it's not until September 12th, where they start admitting, or they go into the final wording of the admission of new states. And actually, they've cleaned up the Constitution to actually the seven articles. And I think the Styles Committee and the Details Committee kind of worked together in doing this. But this is Section 4. And this is actually Article 4, Section 3, I mean. This is the final reading, and I think this is exactly what this Constitution says. New states may be admitted by the Congress into this Union, but no new state shall be formed or erected within the jurisdiction of any other state, nor any state be formed by the junction of two or more states or parts of states without the consent of the legislatures of the states concerned as well as of the Congress. Okay? The Congress shall have power to dispose of and make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory or property belonging to the United States. So as long as it's a territory, and if the counties haven't formed the state yet, it's still a territory. Once it transitions into a state, bing, the magical, you know, twinkling and the poof happens. The federal government has no cognizance. They have no control or jurisdiction over anything within that state other than those few things that are enumerated that they can operate by the procurement of that land. Now, again, I don't know if it was kind of, you know, the state legislatures go, well, you already built it. You already got that. And we're, you know, we need you to be there. So we're just going to, so they didn't necessarily buy that land, you know, after the state became a state when they're already using it. I don't know. And I don't think it's that big of a deal because it is enumerated to have forts, magazines, and so forth and so on, arsenals, shipyards, right? So that, to me, is not a big deal breaker. So as we kind of go down, here's the interesting thing that actually jumps out to me. It's in Article 5. This is the first time that the Amendment Protection Clause shows up. This is where they're actually talking about Article 5 and what to do, you know, as far as how to and who has the authority to amend the Constitution. And this is what this is the Amendment Protection Clause. This is at this point in time, again, on September 12th, not what we have today, but this is what it says. Provided that no amendment which shall be made prior to the year 1808 shall in any manner affect the blank and the blank section of the blank article. In other words, the importation of slaves. This was the importation of slaves trade, and they wanted to make sure that the southern states couldn't acquire a mass or obtain this, what we'll call the ability to amend the Constitution in changing this so that they could maintain slavery. In other words, this was cast in stone. The slave trade must die. That no amendment could be made to take that out. Now, that was it, right? And we know that there's actually another part, a second part of that clause. And so as we go back into the moving forward and so forth, let me cover the militia because on Friday, September 14th, this is what Colonel Mason starts talking about on the militia. Being sensible that an absolute prohibition of standing armies in a time of peace might be unsafe and wishing at the same time to insert something pointing out and guarding against the danger of them, move to preface the clause, Article 1, Section 8, to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia, etc., with the words, quote, and that the liberties of the people may be better secured against the danger of standing armies in the time of peace. Mr. Randolph seconded that motion. Mr. Madison was in favor of it. It did not restrain Congress from establishing a military force in time of peace if found necessary. And as armies in time of peace are allowed on all hands to be an evil, it is well to discountenance them by the Constitution as far as will consist with the essential power of the government on that head. Mr. Governor Morris opposed the motion as setting a dishonorable mark of distinction on the military class of citizens. Mr. Pinckney and Bedford concurred on the opposition on that question. And so Mr. Mason's motion in making this, you know, and it was seconded, this motion went down this way. New Hampshire said no. Massachusetts said no. Connecticut said no. New Jersey said no. Pennsylvania said no. Delaware said no. Maryland said no. Virginia said yes. North and South Carolina said no. And Georgia said yes. So it flamed down that they weren't going to add that because they didn't think that it added anything. And Madison was right. I honestly believe that it should have actually been included. But, you know, Mason, being the man that he is, he wants to make sure you understood what he said, moved to strike out from the clause, Article 1, Section 9, quote, no bill of attainder nor any ex post facto law shall be passed. The words, nor any ex post facto law. He thought that not sufficiently clear that the prohibition meant by this phrase as limited to cases of criminal nature, and no legislature did or can altogether void them in civil cases. Mr. Gary seconded the motion, but with a view of extent prohibition to civil cases, close quote, which he thought ought to be done. On the question, all the states were no, and so it didn't carry. So in other words, this was Article 1, Section 9, that the federal government could not create bills of attainder or make this change to avoiding them for civil cases, in the occurrence of civil cases. Anyway, it failed. So, Mr. Sherman, it is unnecessary. The power of Congress does not extend to the press. So this is where they start going down this Bill of Rights, and they start actually going and chasing these things. And they basically say, no, 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 because it's not enumerated. Again, this goes back to how some of these guys wanted to have these reservations. They couldn't do this, they couldn't do this, they couldn't do this. Instead of actually just saying, these are the only things they can do. So that's how it went. And then on September 15th, the Amendment Protection Clause was then brought up. Mr. Sherman moved, according to his idea above expressed, to annex the end of the article, a further proviso that no state shall, without its consent, be affected in its internal police or deprived of its equal suffrage in the Senate. And so Mr. Madison began with these special provisos, and every state will insist on them for their boundaries, exports, and etc. On the motion of Mr. Sherman, New Hampshire said no, Massachusetts said no, Connecticut said yes, New Jersey said yes, Pennsylvania said no, Delaware said yes, Maryland said no, Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia said no. Mr. Sherman then moved to strike out Article 5 altogether. The ability to amend the Constitution and having a constitutional convention. Mr. Beerley seconded the motion on which New Hampshire said no, Massachusetts said no, Connecticut said yes, New Jersey said yes, Pennsylvania said no, Delaware was divided, Maryland said no, Virginia said no, and all the rest of the states. So in other words, they weren't going to strike it out. Mr. Governor Morris moved, because you've heard this conversation about going back and forth of having the convention. So the convention was added at the very end, and the convention and this amendment process. And then they wanted to add these provisos or this amendment protection clause. So Mr. Governor Morris moved to annex the further provisio that no state without its consent shall be deprived of its equal suffrage in the Senate. This motion being dictated by the circulating murmurs of the small states was agreed to without debate and no one opposing it on the other question of saying no. Do you understand what just happened? They added without any debate because the smaller states demanded it. In other words, they were saying, hey, you know what? They're going to try to take away the state legislature's suffrage down the road. They're going to make an amendment that actually changes the state suffrage and representation, that it won't be equally based. In other words, and we'll get back into this when we come back, because I'll read that and then I'll help you explain why the 17th Amendment absolutely violates the Article 5 Amendment Protection Clause, or I should say, the way the Senate is behaving, they are in abject violation of the Article 5 and the suffrage of the state legislatures. We'll be right back after this. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so again, we're talking about the Amendment Protection Clause and that they included this provisio. Madison said, we don't need these provisios. All the states will want something. And then it was basically brought in, and I'm trying to remember who was that actually brought it in. Mr. Sherman from Connecticut, a smaller state. And he basically wanted to make sure that the states couldn't be deprived of their equal suffrage, nor could they have, you know, the federal government come in and change their internal policing and such. In other words, basically seize control, martial law, that type of thing. And so Madison goes, we don't need to do this because it's just going to open up the floodgates of, you know, appeasing everybody, all these little states. And so it failed. I mean, it failed dramatically because New Jersey and Connecticut were like the only two that really, and Delaware, and the rest of the states, Massachusetts being a big state at that point in time, New Hampshire not, but anyway, and they may not have felt the threat, but apparently the threat was real, and Mr. Sherman then moved to strike out Article 5 altogether. And that failed. I mean, so maybe it was shock value. Maybe he was out there trying to, you know, make this, you know, go out with a bang type of thing. So then Mr. Governor Morris again then said, well, then let's change the provisio to this, that no state without its consent shall be deprived of its equal suffrage in the Senate. Okay, so that actually, you know, passed. And actually, this is what he said to follow this. The motion being dictated by the circulating rumors of the small states in the convention themselves. They were already, you know, worried about this problem that they may lose their equal suffrage. So they ingrained in the Constitution, tucked way down in Article 5, this protection that the state legislatures could never lose their equal suffrage, that no amendment could allow them to lose their equal suffrage without their consent. Now, let's go to the 17th Amendment, because this is really where, you know, where we start separating what the truth is, or what is the 17th Amendment? Is the 17th Amendment taking away the suffrage of the state? In other words, does the Senate have any accountability to the state legislatures in the 17th Amendment? Does it change that at all? This is what it says. Oh, this is the 7th Amendment. I'm sorry. Let me put an X in front of that V. Okay. This is the 17th Amendment. The Senate of the United States shall be composed of two senators from each state, elected by the people thereof for 6 years, and each senator shall have one vote. The electors in each state shall have the qualifications requisite for electors of the most numerous branch of the state legislatures. When vacancies happen in representation of any state in the Senate, the executive authority of such state shall issue writs of election in to fill such vacancies, provided that the legislature of any state may empower the executive thereof to make temporary appointments until the people fill the vacancies by election as the legislature may direct. This amendment shall not be so construed to affect the election or term of any senator chosen before it becomes valid as part of the Constitution. So did it change anything other than how the selection of senators were to be done? Currently, and what this does is it changes Article 1, Section 2 or 3, how senators are chosen. The state legislature in the original was that the state legislatures chose their senators. They had a problem getting senators to be chosen out of state legislatures. Believe it or not, folks, progressive states were deliberately withholding a selection for a senator to go into the Senate. So the Senate was having a hard time getting quorum, which caused this drive by these progressive states to say, we want, you know, since the state legislature won't do these things, I mean, this was a setup from the beginning. But since the state legislatures won't do this, then let's, you know, let the people choose the senator. That's all it does. It doesn't change who they're representing. In other words, it's clear in Article 5, there's nowhere in here where they're saying that the Senate is giving up, or the state legislature is giving up its equal suffrage. Is it changing the suffrage to the people, or is it changing the suffrage to the state, or maintaining the state, the suffrage? There's nothing in here that changes the suffrage. It only changes the process of appointment. But what happens, and the language in this amendment does basically is a sleight of hand to say, he who pays the piper calls the tune. And so the senators are, because there's nothing in here that says that they are, you know, they no longer have to provide suffrage to the state legislature. So technically, every state legislature out there should actually tell exactly how their senators to vote. And if they don't vote the way they demand they vote, then they have to either defend themselves or they will be removed, because they're violating the U.S. Constitution, Article 5. Because as we've gone through this, and as we just went through how this amendment was changed, that no state without its consent shall be deprived of its equal suffrage in the Senate. Boom, done. So did the states give their consent to lose their suffrage in the Senate? No. They are still expecting their suffrage. They just don't have to worry about the administrative details of selecting who is going to represent them. They've turned it over to the people to represent them. In other words, let the people choose who's going to represent the state legislature. Fine. The 17th Amendment did not change the duties of the senators and representing the state legislature, period. What it did was it created this paradigm, and because everybody is so ignorant regarding Article 5 and this consent, you know, must be given, so what has to happen? And it's this simple, folks. What absolutely has to happen is that the state legislatures need to actually go back into a convention, or go back into the question of the 17th Amendment, due to the fact that all they've got to do is basically ping, ping, ping their senators to say, are you listening to us? Are you giving us our suffrage? And if the senators say pack sand, and if the senators do not follow and they say, you know what, instead of trying to impeach you, we are rescinding the 17th Amendment. And because we're rescinding the 17th Amendment, we're no longer giving you consent, because bottom line, state folks, there's no amendment that changed Article 5. So what does this mean? What this means is that no state without its consent shall be deprived of its equal suffrage in the Senate. So if you didn't actually pass and ratify the 17th Amendment, and there are seven states out there, I believe, I'd have to pull it all up. It's in my article, The Recension of the 17th Amendment. Utah, Georgia, and many of the states that did not ratify the 17th Amendment are not obligated to allow the people to vote for their senators. The state legislatures can still appoint them. They're not obligated because Article 5 protects them of that. Did they give consent? No. And this amendment was actually taken through the state legislatures. It wasn't done through a convention of the people. So in other words, they had to give their consent to, you know, at bottom line, they never gave their consent to losing their suffrage. They only gave consent to the changing. And if bottom line, they are not happy with what's happened from the changing because they've actually lost their suffrage, then all they have to do is rescind it. Now, how can they do that? Once you've, because the 14th Amendment, you couldn't do that. The federal government did not allow states to change their positions. And tomorrow on, you know, Friday, Feedback Friday, I'm going to dive into this. I'm going to have it all set up so I can go through who voted for it when, and then later on, after it was ratified, how states tried to quickly unring their bell, and it was too late. Plus, the federal government said, no, you cannot change your position. Not at all. Bottom line, if one state can't change its position, no state can change its position on that amendment. It doesn't mean that, like the 17th Amendment, we're going to get into this, that Delaware, I already mentioned this, and I talk about this all the time, that the dolt, Joe Biden, I mean, the biggest idiot of all times. I mean, the one thing I liked about Harding, he was a corrupt man. He should never have been a president. He was a corrupt president, and he was self-admitted. But at least he was honest of saying he was corrupt and he had no business being in the White House. Joe Biden doesn't even have a shred of honesty to actually say that. I mean, he can't carry Harding's water. He is such a dolt. But, I digress. What we want to dive into is this pressure that Vice President Dolt Biden placed upon Delaware. Apparently, it came to his knowledge that, you know, Delaware is a progressive state and they didn't pass that amendment. And hey, wouldn't it be great if Delaware changed their position and instead of rejecting, they formally rescinded their rejection and ratified that amendment? And they did. And guess what? The federal government accommodated them and put a check next to their name that they did ratify. And because the federal government allowed a state to change its position, that door has to swing both ways. Oh, well, you can change if you've rejected to ratify, but you can't change your ratification to rejection? I'm sorry. That it doesn't work that way. If you're allowing people to change their position on the 17th Amendment, and in 2010, they did that. And it wasn't a one-day thing. As soon as they opened that door, that door is open for that amendment, and it's stuck open. What that means, folks, is you can start pressuring your state. And as a matter of fact, I want to give you a shout-out. Because this actually came up in the state of Washington's convention, because we're actually helping to educate people and they're looking at ways, you know, the problem is when we're dealing with the party, we're dealing with players in the party, they always lean on political theatrics instead of doing the right thing. Oh, well, let's try to go down this path. We want to do this and make it seem like that they're really good guys doing good things. And I'm here to tell you, political theatrics, I don't buy it anymore. It's just showmanship. That's all it is. And it's a facade. It's a waste of time. And the outcome is never good. Never good. So as we go on, and as a matter of fact, let me see here. That passed. Oh, yeah. There's one more thing that we need to get into. And as we were kind of wrapping up, this became the final day. And I've talked about this before. This is September 17th. And this is when the Constitution is getting ready to be signed. And Mr. Gorham said, if it's not too late, he could wish for the purpose of lessening objections to the Constitution, that the clause declaring the number of representatives shall not exceed one for every 40,000, which had produced so much discussion, might be yet reconsidered in order to strike out 40,000 and insert 30,000, close quote. This would not, he remarked, establish that an absolute rule, but only give Congress a greater latitude, which could not be thought unreasonable. Mr. King and Mr. Carroll seconded and supported the idea of Mr. Gorham. When the president rose, now folks, this never happened. This is the only time Madison actually talked about the president, all caps. This is George Washington in the convention. When he rose for the purpose of putting the question, he said that although his situation has hitherto restrained him from offering his sentiments on questions depending in this House, in other words, in this convention, and it might be thought ought not to impose silence upon him, yet he could not forbear expressing his wish that the alteration proposed might take place. It was much to be desired that the objections to the plan. Now, I want you to think about this, folks. There are people that have been disparaging George Washington and the framers. There's a huge propaganda campaign that started decades ago to actually bring bad light, and I question everything that's come out on these guys. Because why is it all of a sudden in the age of the communist cult, the cultural revolution, the counterculture revolution, and this Bolshevik revolution, why is it all of a sudden these types of things are permeated? And I believe it's all about creating and changing the sentiments without giving people the facts. But here's Washington, supposedly, you know, this bad guy that doesn't want people to be represented. He sat there and listened and listened and listened. And then he basically said that, and it might be thought, ought not to impose silence on him, yet he could not forbear expressing his wish that the alteration might be proposed might take place. It was much to be desired that the objections of the plan recommended might be made as few as possible. In other words, he thought that this would really help the Constitution. The smallness of the proportion of representatives had been considered by many members of the convention an insufficient security for the rights of the interest of the people. He, President Washington, or George Washington, acknowledged that it had always appeared to himself among the exceptional parts of the plan, and late as the present moment was for admitting amendments, he thought of so much consequence it would give much satisfaction to see it adopted. No opposition was made to the proposition of Mr. Gorham, and it was agreed to unanimously. On the question to agree to the Constitution enrolled in order to be signed, it was agreed to all, and basically, boom, it was all done. They all answered aye, as far as the states go. Then Mr. Randolph then rose with an illustration to the observation of Dr. Franklin, apologized for refusing to sign the Constitution, notwithstanding the vast majority and venerable names that would give sanction to its wisdom and its worth. He said, however, that he did not mean by this refusal to decide that he should oppose the Constitution without doors. He meant only to keep himself free to be governed by his duty as to be prescribed. So in other words, he's just kind of doing damage of why at the, you know, the last minute he actually said, I'm not going to sign this Constitution. Mr. Morris made his observations. These are some, you know, some of the final little observations. And here's what Mr. Franklin said. And Mr. Franklin expressed his fears from that, what Mr. Randolph said, that he thought himself alluded to in the remarks offered this morning to the House. He declared that when drawing up the paper, he did not know that any particular member would refuse to sign his name to the instrument, and hoped to be so understood. He professed a high sense of obligation to Mr. Randolph for having brought forward the plan in the first instance, and for the assistance he had given in the progress, and hoped that he would yet lay aside his objections and, by concurring with his brethren, prevent the great mischief which the refusal of his name might produce. It goes on, and at the very end, Dr. Franklin basically, you know, makes this observation, and I'm trying to find it, where he talks about the sun. And if you remember, there is this, I think there's this artwork incurred or is set into this chair. This is what it says. Whilst the last members were signing it, Dr. Franklin, looking towards the president's chair that he sat in this whole time, at the back of which a rising sun happened to be painted, observed to a few members near him that painters had often found it difficult to distinguish in their art a rising from a setting sun. I have said often and often in the course of the session and the vastitudes of my hopes and fears as to its issue, looked at that behind the president without being able to tell whether it was a rising or setting. But now at length I have the happiness to know that it is a rising sun, not a setting sun. That was an observation, one of the final observations before they all kind of went their merry ways. And then I believe it was Franklin that was asked, I forget the gal's name, but it was a lady, you know, well, what kind of government do we have? And he says, well, it's a Republican, if you can keep it. Folks, this concludes, so I thought maybe it would meander into next week. So this concludes the Madison's notes on the Constitution Convention. There are lots of things in here. Reading through these debates and how things started, and you can tell that there were men that were very boisterous. And as a matter of fact, I would challenge anybody to do a lot of detailed analysis, because I think if you did and you looked at the names of people who spoke, there were a lot of silent men in these other states. I mean, we only heard from the chatterboxes. I mean, it seemed like certain states had really chattery boxes, right? South Carolina, Butler, Pinckney, with Virginia, we had Mason, we had Madison, we even had Randolph. But there were more than just those men. And one of the things that has profoundly helped me see things with a different view is we can't judge the document based on the words being presented in the debate completely. And I say that because 9 times out of 10, the negative, the squeaky wheel, seems to be persistent. In other words, they do everything they possibly can. And even though the negative comments may be a majority of the document, a majority of the testimony given, at the end, when the effects, the changes, and the outcome goes contrary to those words, then it helps us understand that they were just being squeaky wheels, that these were the few people that really were doing everything they could to obfuscate the outcome of this Constitutional Convention. And it was actually Professor Kurt Lash in his article, and it was a 3-part article regarding the Privileges and Immunities Clause of the 14th Amendment. where he pointed out that when you look at the debates in Congress, out of the 260-some pages, that was actually, I included some Freeman Bureau and other stuff that was kind of pertinent to what was going on in that 263 pages. So it's over 200 pages, the debates specifically on the 14th Amendment, well over 200 pages. And when I say 200 pages, that's three page per page. What does that mean? Go look, the debates in Congress are on my website on the Constitutional Articles page. Go look at that and look at that column. There are three columns per page. The words that are in one column would equate to a single Word document page. In other words, the way we think pages today is one-third of the page that they were writing then. And so when I say 200-some pages, that's actually 600-some pages, if you know what I mean. So as we look at the 14th Amendment, and out of that 600-some pages, the majority of all the negative comments that were coming seemed to actually overpower, you know, the positive. And it seemed like, well, if that's the case, then how in the heck did that amendment pass? And the reality is that the majority of the people rejected. I mean, it was just squeak, squeak. It was just an annoyance. Why did we have to suffer through all of that? This is why, for the longest time, I've told people that when you go through these debates, and it's pretty tough with the Constitutional Convention because they're in a creation mode. They're not debating the actual words to accept or, like a ratification. The ratification and the debates in creation kind of help you see how things morph. And the 14th Amendment is basically that. But as things morphed and they made these in changes, and as a matter of fact, I encourage anybody to go look at Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. It's original, the first time Section 3 even showed up. It was clear that Section 3 was all about punishing those rebel members of the Confederate States so that they couldn't come back into office. It was completely changed and converted to basically make all things moving forward that nobody could be in office anymore if they supported or if they failed to support the Constitution and gave aid and comfort to the enemies thereof the Constitution. And so as we move, get ready to move into the ratification debates, tomorrow's Feedback Friday, we'll go into the ratification debates next week. What I'm going to do is I'm going to dive into the ratification debates kind of in order of first, the states that actually covered. So go through all of the debates on very specific topics, and then I'm going to go through the bulk of the debates on the normal topics, the normal conversations over the militia, enumerated powers, those types of things. But there's very specific things that I want to make sure we dive into, such as the federal powers of the standing armies, the concept of the militias, and those types of things, because we really need to look at how the federal government has this authority to enforce any law that they create by creating their own army. Is just, I'm baffled. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.